The Texas General Land Office has a question for many towns and cities. After Harvey, how would you spend $4 billion? The mayor of Rockport weighs in today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. The eyes of many Texans on the impeachment drama on Capitol Hill. Not all Texas lawmakers singing the same tune on that score. We'll have details. The headlines say in the Permian Basin, the pump jacks are pumping and all's well for oil wells. But a closer look finds subtle signs of a downturn. We'll take a closer look. And the potential return of a Texas political dynasty? All that and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Monday, December 9th. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. We hope your week's off to a terrific start. It's about to be a terrific restart for the Fulton Mansion in Aransas County, a massive Second Empire-style building that withstood more than eight hurricanes since its construction in 1877. That is before Harvey took its toll along the Texas Gulf Coast. After Harvey moved on, one of the first things locals wanted to know was, how's the mansion? Is it still standing? Well, yes, it was still mostly there, but the Texas historic site suffered massive damage to its roof and third floor. Now Channel 3 KIII in Corpus Christi reports that after more than $1 million in renovations, the mansion set to reopen its doors to the public on December 14th, just a few days from now. But not such a happy ending for many others, however, especially everyday folk whose homes were severely damaged and who've been working, waiting, and hoping for recovery funds since the disaster of late summer 2017. With damage estimates totaling around $125 billion, it is the costliest tropical cyclone on record after Katrina. The Texas General Land Office has proposed a state plan to help mitigate damage from Harvey through community development block grants, a plan valued at more than $4 billion, with funds coming from the federal government. But right now, they're trying to get input from affected communities like Rockport, where Patrick Rios is mayor. Mayor Rios, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you very much.
I gather you met with General Land Office officials last week. Is that right?
We did. We had pleased that they decided to hold one of their workshops here and take community input on the pending funds.
How are you supposed to use these funds? What does it mean, community development block grants?
What we're looking at are mitigation uses for the funds. We're looking at how we can make our community more resilient, harden our resources against any future storm. We know there'll be another storm, just don't know when. Hopefully we don't have one for another 47 years. That was the time span between last hurricane and Harvey. But we want to take those funds and work on infrastructure. We're looking at streets, drainage, water treatment plants, so that we don't suffer so much of the damage that we went through with Harvey.
Do you like what the General Land Office has in mind? They say they've drawn up these plans. How specific are they? Or are they still counting on you to provide them with details?
Well, we've been working on plans. In fact, prior to the storm, we had a group together, a committee together called the Aransas County Resiliency Initiative. And it was comprised of stakeholders from all over the community, not mm-hmm. just Rockport, but Aransas County in general. Mm-hmm. And we had identified many, many projects from a perspective of what's going to happen if.
Yeah.
So we took a lot of those projects, modified them somewhat, and have already placed many of those into the process, both restore, but mitigation funds. It's interesting that these funds that are coming up are not necessarily Harvey dependent. It helps if, you know, they'll look at you different ways if you were impacted by Harvey, but mm-hmm. they don't have to be to repair Harvey damage. They could be used to prevent future damage.
Very interesting. Is there going to be competition for this money?
Absolutely. We're fortunate that Houston has their own set of money out there. But when you look at all the different communities, the 14 coastal communities that were affected, you look at areas that with much greater population, things like the Fort Bend County area, Sugarland, Wharton, all those different areas where there's so much more population than we have down here. Our approach that we're looking at right now is to approach it from a regional perspective. We're going to partner with our local communities here, Corpus Christi, the Port Authority, the different towns, Aransas Pass, Portland, Port Aransas, Refugio, everyone up and down the coast that's close by. The city of Rockport, for example, is 8,500 people. You compare that to Sugar Land, and that's not even a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But if we look at it from a regional perspective and what happens here, especially with the impact we have on, all of our industry in this area is tied to, so much of it is tied to the energy industry. Mm-hmm. We have to make sure we protect all of that. And I think if we look at it again from a regional perspective, we'll get a lot give us a bigger advantage in competition for those funds.
What kind of work still needs to be done where you are? I mean, have you received the sort of federal and state aid that you were hoping for?
Well, we're still waiting for it. A lot has been promised. It can be frustrating at times. You know, we have to look at all the promises made and promises actually followed through on. We're just now starting to see some of our affordable housing projects mm-hmm. slip into gear. We had one project open with 40 units. We've got two more that are finally under construction within the last 60 days.
Yeah.
So it's been well over 2 years since the storm. We had virtually no affordable housing left for a workforce, and we're just starting to see that. A year and a half from now, we should be in better shape. We should have a lot more of those projects online.
This money could go a long way, it sounds like, for you.
Absolutely. It's very needed. The city of Rockport is our industry is tourism. So we're based on bringing folks here to enjoy our beaches, our fishing, the water, the food we've got. And we've got plenty of that still, but we just need to get everything back in place. Pretty much all of our hotels that are going to open have reopened now, which is a plus. Mm-hmm. It's just difficult finding staff for those places. Right now, a lot of the different businesses are actually bringing people in by bus every morning from mm-hmm. neighboring communities, Corpus Christi, Victoria, places like
yeah.
that.
Patrick Rios is the mayor of Rockport, Texas, still struggling to get back to 100% more than 2 years after Hurricane Harvey. Mayor Rios, thanks again.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Well, the House continues to pursue the impeachment of President Trump, assuming that happens, and that is highly expected at this point. It won't actually mean his removal from office, of course. That would take a 2/3 vote of the Senate. And where does the senior senator from Texas stand? Let's just say he stands in contrast to some of his fellow Texas lawmakers on the other side of the Capitol building. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports.
Saying she had no choice but to act, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced Thursday she wanted House committee chairs to proceed with articles of impeachment.
The facts are uncontested. The president abused his power for his own personal political benefit.
In the 6-minute formal address, the San Francisco Democrat said President Trump's actions strike at the very heart of our Constitution. But speaking to reporters in a conference call, Texas Senator John Cornyn called into question Pelosi's motivations.
I think she's lost control of her own radical base among House Democrats and is doing this against her better judgment.
Cornyn, a high-ranking Senate Republican, said he can only reach this conclusion about Pelosi based on what she has said in the past about impeachment.
But I don't believe she thinks this is a prudent action from a political standpoint. Some have predicted that this goes a long way to ensuring President Trump's reelection because of the perception that this is a partisan exercise.
But Texas Congressman Lloyd Doggett disagrees. He said Pelosi's actions are not radical.
The only thing radical here is the radical disregard for our Constitution and the safeguards that our founders put in place to prevent autocracy.
Doggett, a Democrat who represents parts of San Antonio and Austin, said Pelosi was forced to take this action because of Trump's behavior in office.
And basically saying, as he told a group here earlier in the summer, that he's empowered to do whatever he wants to do. That's not what our Constitution does.
Cornyn, who is seeking his fourth term as senator next year, said Pelosi has failed to gain bipartisan support for impeachment, and that undermines credibility for the action.
Earlier this year, where she said that impeachment was such a serious matter that it would never be successful unless it was bipartisan and unless the American people supported it, she threw that overboard.
Doggett said impeachment isn't bipartisan because of Republicans like Cornyn, who have put their party over their duty to the country and the Constitution.
If there is anything more tragic than seeing the damage that Donald Trump is doing to our democracy as a wannabe tyrant, it is all of the Republican enablers who have permitted him to do that.
Cornyn told reporters that he hasn't seen anything in the investigation that rises to the level of impeachment and removal for Trump.
The president said that he wasn't going to send foreign aid to Ukraine, to a corrupt country, and in the process asked for an investigation into one aspect of that corruption, which was happened to involve the vice president's son.
But Doggett said Trump doesn't have a record of ever being concerned with corruption, not even in his own administration.
His concern is his personal advancement, his personal political gain, not in trying to discover or prevent any corruption there or elsewhere. I think we have perhaps the most corrupt administration in American history.
If something was wrong with the actions of President Trump, Cornyn said, then the American electorate should be the ones to sort that out.
Why don't we just have an election the old-fashioned way in November 2020 and people can cast their vote? But this is a very dramatic and virtually unprecedented exercise of congressional power.
Doggett said, with Trump in office, the future of America cannot wait for a presidential election and then months later for an inauguration.
Well, I have concern about President Trump in office every day. I think every day he is there, America is weakened, and our family security is threatened. It's never America first, it's always Trump first.
Cornyn also had a warning for Democrats. If they are successful, they should be concerned because the same impeachment efforts could be used against future Democrats who occupy the White House. David Martin Davies reporting.
Well, let's find out what Texans are talking about on social media. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David.
Hello.
As we were just hearing reactions to President Trump and his tenure in the White House, no small point of discussion, and that includes another topic related to his tenure as president, the hearing of the Judiciary Committee focused on presenting evidence in support of impeachment of President Donald Trump. That hearing underway today, and we're hearing from our friends and listeners who are keeping a keen eye on the proceedings. On our Facebook page, Tanya Sampson points to these remarks from House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy. He said it was unprecedented to impeach a president in the first term. Unprecedented, referring to the three times in our history when this has been done, Tanya points out. I guess that's technically correct. Mm-hmm. It would be unprecedented.
Yep.
Yet still, Meg Hertz says, Democrats don't like him. Seems to be the main Republican defense, that and trying to usurp process, or their complaints that Democrats are usurping process in their impeachment proceedings. And another listener adds, when Republicans say Democrats are rushing without hearing from all the witnesses and getting all the documentation, tell that to the White House, referring there to its lack of cooperation in allowing witnesses to go forward and provide documents, so on and so forth. So, unsurprisingly, impeachment proceedings still a big buzz out there on social media.
I rather think it will be for a better part of this week. We'd love to hear what's making news in your part of Texas. Tweet us, won't you? Or just join us on the social media platform of your choice. You know how to find us. Just look for Texas Standard. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, will be back in about 35 minutes with more of your comments from all across the Lone Star State. Howdy, you're got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A new Associated Press investigation finds accidental shootings by law enforcement officers happen more frequently than many might think. More than 1,400 unintentional shootings by officers at some 258 agencies since 2012, according to the AP. 22 of those shootings occurred at schools or college campuses. See, officers are sometimes stationed in schools to protect students, right? Well, Guns in America's Aditu Bunlamudi wanted to find out what kind of training they're getting. A warning here to listeners, this story contains the sound of gunshots.
The Samarkand Training Academy is a huge law enforcement training facility nestled in rural Moore County, North Carolina. Corrections, probation, and parole officers all train here. They also host special training for school resource officers, or SROs.
It is octagon. It's five screens. There is a stage. And each part of the screen is part of the scenario.
That's Mike Kimbrell, the rangemaster at Samarkand. He's describing the room that SROs train in. Samarkand uses a special software called Virtra, which puts officers in realistic situations, like an active shooter situation. They use virtual reality to test how they would react in real life. And a warning, it gets pretty loud.
Where's he at? Where's he at? Where's he at?
Vertra uses footage from an SRO's actual school for the simulation, and then superimposes a school shooter, played by an actor, in it. The SRO uses a laser gun to point and shoot at the virtual gunman. Jericho Lowry is an SRO at nearby Pinecrest High School in Moore County.
First time I stepped on, first scenario, the floor does vibrate if there is explosions, gunshots. The noise helps you.
The National Association of School Resource Officers believe SROs have three jobs to fill: to be an educator, informal counselor or mentor, and a law enforcement officer.
You know, a lot of times I buy lunches and things, and then they come to you with coaching things. I enjoy helping with the different teams. I do a lot with them, especially basketball. I like the basketball teams.
Lowry has done Vertra training about 3 or 4 times and feels ready to take on an active shooter. But in his 3 years as an SRO, he has yet to deal with an active shooter on campus. And that's not a surprise. School shootings remain very rare and account for less than 2% of all youth homicides in the U.S. Plus, the latest U.S. Secret Service report found that from 2008 to 2017, only 12% of targeted school violence, which includes school shootings, were ended by an SRO. Most days, Lowry deals with more mundane problems.
A lot of it would be drama spawned from social media, you know, asking for help. Hey, this person said this person's done that. Well, you know, what do I do? What do I say? I don't want to get in a fight.
On average, for every 482 students in U.S. public schools, there's one guidance counselor. That means limited one-on-one time for kids in need. And sometimes that leaves educators and SROs to fill that gap.
We put police officers in schools expecting them to be social workers, and they're not trained as social workers.
That's Aaron Kupchik. He's a professor at the University of Delaware and has studied school resource officers and their effect on a school environment. He believes most SROs are well-intentioned and want to help students, but
presence can shape the school's social climate and make it slightly less oriented to students' social, academic, and emotional needs, and slightly more oriented towards law enforcement.
Mike Anderson agrees with him. He works at North Carolina's Center for Safer Schools. He helps create SRO training curriculum in the state and used to be an SRO himself. He says one thing he tries to stress during training is that SROs are law enforcement first, school employees second.
We've got nothing to do with school policy. You know, we have everything to do with state law and local ordinances.
But Anderson says communication is important to learn because most of an SRO's job is to talk to kids and to de-escalate any violence.
We have trained law enforcement on the hard stuff, I do think we need to start teaching that communication aspect again because, you know, like I said to some of my younger officers, you know, I've talked my way out of more fights than I've ever been in a fight.
Anderson says communication is a hard skill to fit into a curriculum, but he wants to see more of it in training moving forward. For Guns in America, I'm Aditi Bandlamudi.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. If you've ever been out to West Texas, you've seen them, plumes of fire shooting from the tops of tall pipes amid the scrub and pump jacks. This is natural gas flaring, the burn-off of excess energy from the petroleum extraction process. Natural gas flaring in the U.S. has reached an all-time high, 1.28 billion cubic feet per day. This, according to new figures from the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the EIA, and some states are flaring more than others. Matt Smith has the lowdown. He's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thanks, David.
This flaring business, I would think it would be a dubious distinction, perhaps, to be among those states flaring the most, because that means basically you're not capturing energy that what could be channeled back into the system, no?
Yeah, exactly, David. And the point you make there, 1.28 BCF per day, that actually equates to about 1% of total production. So that is just being wasted going out into the atmosphere. That said, flaring is actually, believe it or not, the lesser of the two evils. So venting the gas, which is directly releasing it into the atmosphere, is actually worse because methane is a more potent greenhouse gas. So it is actually less destructive. Or it's a less destructive process to burn the methane and create carbon dioxide instead. But it's an amazing stat, isn't it? 1% of total production just going out into the atmosphere.
So who's doing more of this flaring?
Well, there's two states across the U.S. which account for 82% of the total gas flared. North Dakota is accounting for 31%, while here's the bad news, Texas accounts for 51%.
Wow. That's huge. What could be done about that? I mean, obviously, I take your point that it'd be worse if they were just letting it go off into the air. So at least you're trying to burn it, and that gives you the CO2. But is there not another way, a third option here, a way perhaps that could be monetized?
Well, the most obvious one is to get the infrastructure in place and get it out and being consumed via pipelines, bringing that gas to market. But what you've got essentially is production basically outpacing that pipeline build out. So a lot of this natural gas is associated gas, is coming out of oil wells. So as oil production continues to rise, you're continuing to get more natural gas, which just isn't being captured here.
Is there a market for the natural gas? That is to say, if you were to build that infrastructure, would it be worth it?
Well, yeah. So what we've got now, we've got about 40% of new pipeline capacity that is currently in the works that is being developed for the South Central region. And so that's about 7.2 BCF a day, which is going to be heading to basically the Texas region. And so even if it isn't necessarily consumed there, it could be piped elsewhere or it could be exported. And so either of those options seems better than it being flared. But it really is just trying to keep up with the increasing volumes. There just isn't the pipelines to capture it all.
Well, is there any indication that this will change in the foreseeable future?
Yeah, so they're working on it, but it's just that game of catch up. And so we've been seeing flaring in North Dakota for many years now. And as much as they've tried to resolve it, they just haven't been able to. Hopefully, as Texas continues to build out pipeline capacity, we'll see that tackled somewhat better.
We're going to be talking about the picture in the Permian Basin a little more in just a couple of minutes. Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clifford Data. Matt, great to speak with you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hey, what was the temperature when you got up this morning? Did you have to do a double take on that calendar too? Yeah, it was a little warmer than usual, warmer than normal here in the Texas capital city. And then I found out that we were going to reach a high today in the mid-80s. That's not going to be sustained. It's going to get chilly out there, so keep those coats handy.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Democratic presidential candidate Julian Castro will be on the Texas primary ballot for Super Tuesday in March. The former San Antonio mayor got his paperwork in Sunday before today's filing deadline. Castro did not qualify for his party's primary debate in November and has yet to meet the polling requirements for the one later this month. He explains why he's in the race.
I have been standing up for people who need a voice, for people who are often forgotten in this country.
That audio is courtesy of the CBS affiliate in Austin. As of this morning, 16 Democratic presidential candidates have filed to appear on the primary ballot in Texas. The Mexican government is attempting to clear a migrant tent encampment in Matamoros across the border from Brownsville, Texas. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. reports more than 1,500 asylum seekers have been living there for months.
This weekend, Mexican government officials and law enforcement came to the tent encampment to try and convince migrants to move to a new government structure by the Rio Grande. Officials said the move would be optional, but some migrants at the camp say they're being forced, including a woman who didn't want her name being used because she feared speaking out would put her in danger.
Andan federales.
The woman says there was federal police and all types of police, and it didn't feel like they had a choice. Rather, it felt like they had to move. She said there was even immigration officials with cameras, and so they all felt intimidated. The migrants are waiting here for their immigration court cases to unfold in the U.S. under the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Matamoros.
A city in the Rio Grande Valley will soon receive more than $109,000 in federal reimbursements for providing services this year to migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. McAllen City Manager Roy Rodriguez says the funds will help cover costs, including transportation expenses, personnel, and signage. He adds currently the city is seeing far fewer migrants.
We're talking about 20 or 25 a day. And so we are not having to provide any service at this point.
Other Texas cities that qualified for federal reimbursements first announced in October include San Antonio, El Paso, and Brownsville. Three men are facing capital murder charges for fatally shooting a key witness in former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger's murder trial. A Dallas County grand jury indicted Thaddeus Charles Green, Jacarius Mitchell, and Michael Diaz Mitchell Thursday. Joshua Brown died days after testifying as a neighbor of Botham Jean, who was fatally shot by Geiger in his home last year. Police say Brown's death resulted from a drug deal dispute. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Texas oil and gas revenues continue spike amid boom in the Permian Basin. So reads a recent headline in the national daily newspaper, and it sounds like, well, happy days never went away. From so much of what we've been hearing of late, that boom in the Permian shows no sign of letting up. But scratch the surface, look and listen a little more closely, and you may find some unmistakable signals that suggest a far different story. Jesse Thompson is a senior business economist at the Houston branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Jesse, welcome to Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
I want to get to something that I read in Bloomberg recently that said, I believe it was by a reporter who spends a lot of time there in the Permian, said radio ads touting Permian Basin jobs have all but disappeared. That's one of those little small signals that something is starting to change. What are you seeing in the numbers?
Well, the oil and gas industry has certainly not had a banner year in terms of employment. You've seen the rig count plateau and begin to turn down in several regions. And you've seen employment growth really flatten, slow down in the Permian Basin. In fact, turned slightly negative for across through October here this year. And in fact, the oil and gas industry is now net negative. They've been shedding jobs this year and shedding jobs at a faster clip than I think many people appreciate.
Is that necessarily a bad thing? I mean, because if you're on a hiring spree, I mean, we've seen situations in the Permian Basin where you've had to bring in workers from far afield, and it's been tough actually finding a right number of folks to deal with what the industry needs.
It's not necessarily a bad thing. If the oil and gas industry is not on a hiring spree, then that means there's potentially more people available for other industries, other firms in the area. And in the case of Midland or Odessa, you always want the oil and gas industry to be healthy. And the other industries in that area, they feed off of the economic activity that is driven by oil and gas. And so it's sort of a mixed blessing. It's a mixed bag. It's a blessing for some, but if this turns into a something more negative, then it could become something of a worry for the regional economy.
In terms of that worry, I suppose we might be looking at the possibility of ripples from some downturn in drilling, hurting oil support industries, and frankly, going all the way, say, to restaurants and that sort of thing, right?
Certainly. So if your rig count is down, if well completions are flattening out or even declining, I don't think that's happened yet. But if that, once that starts to happen, if activity in the oil field starts to slow down, then you've got potentially fewer people out there demanding food and drink. You've got less demand for those services. And certainly on the equipment rentals, on fabrication and metal manufacturing jobs in the region, and all the way following the supply chain all the way back to the coast.
Well, let's talk about those rig counts. You mentioned a few caveats here. How are the rig counts looking right now? What about other hard indicators in the numbers?
So broadly speaking, the rig count has been trending down for much of the year. However, well completion activity has been proved more resilient as firms are also maintaining production. So production driven by the Permian is continuing to grow. However, the overall oil field activity hasn't quite matched that because you've seen this decline in drilling activity and the number of wells drilled.
What do you make of the discrepancy in headlines? On the one hand, we're seeing reports that this best of times in the Permian. On the other hand, we're seeing these stories, like I mentioned, that Bloomberg story talking about
For instance, the radio ads disappearing from the airwaves, and home sales, of course, starting to pick up once again. What do you think?
Well, if you look at certainly at the jobs data for mining, we've seen a downturn year to date in Texas, and most of that is being felt in the West Texas in the Permian Basin. So we've seen mining jobs in Texas by the Bureau of Labor Statistics count are down a little less than 4,000 jobs mm-hmm. year to date this year in Texas. Mm-hmm. But if you were to look at, say, the Dallas Fed numbers, we do early revisions trying to get a picture of what final numbers are going to look like when they get revised next year. That job count is down by over 8,000. So we've seen layoffs pick up. And so certainly I think that the hiring spree has come to an end, and we're seeing some firms still trying to right size, still trying to find ways to either reduce activity or reduce spending in general in order to generate better returns.
The State of the Patch, Jesse Thompson, senior business economist at the Houston branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Jesse, thanks so much for getting us up to speed. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Just seeing an interesting report from CBS DFW. There's a virus that seems to be making the rounds, especially in North Texas, called fifth disease. You get a runny nose maybe a week or two before, and then you get this rash. Apparently, this is not really a cause for major concern among kids, but pregnant women, that may be an issue because it can cause a specific problem in the unborn baby with red blood cells, that sort of thing. So check with your doctors, and once you see the rash, apparently the kids are no longer contagious.
My name is Javier Garza, and I was born and raised in the Rio Grande Valley. And one of the things that I grew up with was the story of a Mexican Santa Claus. Maybe you think you know everything there is to know about Santa Claus, but there might be a few things you don't know about him. Like, for instance, did you know that he's getting older? Or that the number of kids he has to deliver to is getting bigger and bigger every day? Or that Santa Claus is a Mexican cousin? Yes, it's true. Santa's Mexican primo can sing like a mariachi, and his magic sack of toys has just the right present for every boy and girl. Would you like to meet him? This is the story of Charro Gloss and the Texas Kid. It's the night before Christmas, and a boy named Vincent is getting ready for bed. He is spending Christmas Eve with his tío Pancho in their old family farm near the U.S.-Mexico border. He's tired from milking the cows and feeding the chickens, all the things that a little boy has to do to help out at the farm. But as soon as he shuts his eyes, he hears footsteps up on the roof. Thump, thump, thump. Who's up there? Hears his tío Pancho yelling. Vincent looks out the window just in time to see that his uncle is climbing up a ladder. Vincent puts on his boots and runs outside quietly, very quietly, because he doesn't want his uncle to know that he's there. He follows him up the ladder. Aye! Vincent has to cover his mouth to keep from screaming. His uncle is on the roof talking to Santa Claus, who he recognizes because of his big, fluffy white beard and his big, round, round panza. Cousin Santa Claus, Tio Pancho cries. They give each other a great big abrazo. Vincent is stunned. My Uncle Pancho and Santa Claus are primos. They're cousins, but how can this be? I need your help, primo, says Santa Claus. The border along the Rio Grande is too long for an old man like me, especially when I need to deliver presents to every single corner of the world. Can you help me? Tio Pancho frowns. Would I have to wear a red and white suit like you? Not even, answers Santa Claus. You can wear that mariachi outfit you wore back in your singing days. But I was a lot younger then, and thinner too. I put on just a little bit of weight, primo. Never mind that, says Santa Claus. He grabs Tio Pancho's hand, and in the blink of an eye, they slip down the chimney together like magic. And as the story progresses, of course, Uncle Pancho and his nephew Vincent deliver presents to all the kids that live along the U.S.-Mexico border. Do you live near the border between Texas and Mexico? Well, don't be surprised if you happen to look up in the sky one Christmas Eve night and see a wagon being pulled by a pack of flying burritos, all wearing lucha libre masks. If you happen to listen closely, you might even hear Charro Gloss and his sidekick, the Texas Kid, call out to you and tell you Merry Christmas and Feliz Navidad. Javier Garza, reading from excerpts from my book Charro Close and the Texas Kid, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Coming up on 44 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time, I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. When someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia, quite often it's not just the patient's life that changes. Over the next month, Saida Hassan of KERA North Texas will be taking a closer look at how Texans are dealing with the challenges of caring for people with mental health issues. And today she explores how helping a loved one with dementia can be a family affair.
Tet Guerrero is enjoying a sunny afternoon at the Dallas Zoo. His full name is Jose Antonio Guerrero Castillo, but everyone calls him Tech. And he's here with his mother, Maria Luisa Castillo Rocha. Tech stands behind Maria Luisa's wheelchair, snapping photos of lions.
She's a retired banking manager for international banking in Mexico City, so she used to be very social and very verbally engaged.
The zoo's Wild Gatherings program is designed for people like Maria Luisa with early stage dementia.
And we're here because we are hoping that she will oil those motors of social engagement with her.
The program gives Tech a chance to connect with other caregivers, and his mother gets to embrace nature. A zoo employee brings around a lion's skull for her to hold.
Yeah, you can see the teeth right here. Yeah. Look at that.
90-year-old Maria Luisa has been diagnosed with vascular dementia. Symptoms can include trouble paying attention, problem solving, and slower thinking. Decades ago, Maria Luisa mentored other young women in her professional life. Friends and coworkers knew her as someone you could confide in.
I did not learn that my mom had any form of dementia until probably 1 or 2 years after she had been diagnosed. And obviously, being the person affected by it, she didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to it.
Tech was concerned when his mother started showing symptoms, and he began making longer visits to Mexico. It took some convincing, but eventually they decided she should move to Dallas. Today, Maria Luisa's new home is optimized for her care. Tech stores her pills in plastic bins, neatly labeled and stacked in one of his closets. On the patio, Tech's husband Michael Street keeps a lush garden where Maria Luisa enjoys some of her meals. The home is dotted with smart speakers and calendars, outlining the radio shows she likes to listen to. Michael shows me how he can control the programming from his phone.
Every one of these are what radio station is supposed to be on throughout the day. All in Spanish, obviously, from different parts of the Latin-speaking world. So she never has to be bored, no matter what room she's in.
They also take Maria Luisa to weekly group activities, where she socializes with other seniors. Tech says that time is precious. It gives him a chance to catch up on his own responsibilities. It's easy to look at his calendars, his neat stacks of medication, and think Tech has it all figured out. But becoming a caregiver has been a learning process, one he tries to approach with humor.
Yeah, you're going to hear lots of advice, but you have to separate, you know, you have to filter it according to your own life status, right? And in our family, sense of humor is vital. It's paramount. So by every now and then calling ourselves her dads, we're like the gay dads, right? Papa and daddy or something. And she jokes about it constantly.
Since taking on this role, Tech has left his office job and is now freelancing, though he looks forward to going back to work full-time one day. It's a familiar trade-off to the estimated 41 million family caregivers across the country. A recent report from the AARP estimates they provided 34 billion hours of care to loved ones. That's $470 billion in unpaid labor.
Caregivers' duties at first may be light, but over time, as the disease worsens, the caregiver, their duties can turn into 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Imelda Aguirre is with the Dallas and Northeast Texas chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. She says many find themselves caregiving without proper training.
At first, I mean, the caregiver is really overwhelmed with not knowing where to go or what to do or what resources they have available.
Work is underway to help America's caregivers. Last year, President Donald Trump signed the Raise Family Caregiving Act into law. It led to the creation of a new advisory council, which has been working on a national strategy for caregivers, exploring issues like financial security and training. Training that could have helped Tech Guerrero and Michael Street find their way.
Everyone's in a similar boat in terms of daily challenges, but I would say be forgiving with yourself for the errors that you make. Take notes every day and try to simplify life where you can.
Tech and Michael took on the job of caregiver willingly, but that doesn't mean it's always easy to shoulder. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Years ago, the son of a politician from up north put down stakes in Texas and before too long found himself in politics. The late George H.W. Bush came to Texas to be an oil man, but wound up becoming a congressman, a CIA chief, a vice president of the U.S., and then president of the U.S. And part of what would become something of a political dynasty is the father of another president and a governor of Florida, too. He was also the grandfather to Texas's General Land Office Commissioner, and now there's the possibility of the Bush dynasty expanding a bit more, depending on what Texas voters in the 22nd U.S. Congressional District say. Joining us to talk about that, Abby Livingston. She's Washington Bureau Chief for the Texas Tribune, where she's been covering this story. Abby, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
So another Bush putting his hat into the ring here in Texas. Pierce Bush, tell us a little bit about him.
So Pierce Bush, he is in his early 30s, and he is the son of Neil Bush, who is one of the lesser known of the George W. Bush generation. So Neil is the brother of George and Jeb Bush. And so Pierce Bush, I believe, grew up in Houston, and he went to the University of Texas. And this is something we've been watching for a while. Now, we were initially thinking he might run for the Texas 7th Congressional District, which is West Houston. This is Houston proper. This is the ancestral district of the late former President George H.W. Bush when he was a congressman.
Hmm.
But that appears to have been the Republican field was already a little established there. And then a few months later came the retirement of Congressman Pete Olson,
right,
in Sugar Land,
right,
which is the a suburb of Houston. And so we started to hear kind of rumors, and then it became pretty clear over the weekend that Pierce Bush is rolling out a campaign for this congressional seat. But it is no, as I put in my story, nothing is assured. This candidate field on the Republican side alone has over a dozen candidates.
Good night.
So,
wow.
Yes. So, and it may shrink by the end of filing Monday evening, but I think this is going to be a fascinating race in the context of American politics. This is a guy with a priceless asset in his last name of Bush in mm-hmm. the state of Texas, but right, we are in such an anti-establishment era, so it'll be a really interesting thing to watch.
I was going to ask, because you mentioned, you know, Pete Olson he said he's not going to be running for re-election. You mentioned this is kind of through the heart of Houston, and I'm wondering, so much has been changing, especially in big city and suburban politics here in Texas of late. What about on the Democratic side? Are there any well-known challengers?
Absolutely. So the seat in 2016, Pete Olson won by almost 20 points. And then this Democratic unknown candidate who'd been in the Foreign Service named Sri Kulkarni ran against him. And the margin was reduced to 5 points last cycle.
Wow.
Kulkarni is running again. He is of South Asian descent, but also not directly, but he is related to Sam Houston. So, and that's sort of this district in a lot of ways. I think this is probably still a Republican seat. That doesn't mean it can't flip. I just think the DNA of it is, but it is a rapidly changing district demographically. And so this is a seat Democrats are targeting nationally. I think it could actually, if there's any seat in the state that shows the change since Donald Trump was elected, I think it's going to be this one.
You talked about how Pierce Bush comes from one of the lesser known Bush brothers of the generation immediately after George H.W. Bush. How is he? Is he pretty much relying on that last name to be what puts him in front of everyone else? Or is there something that he has done with his career that's going to stand out or that he can kind of hold out to potential voters?
Well, he is extremely passionate about his career over the last, I don't know how long he's been there, but he was the CEO of Big Brothers and Big Sisters Lone Star. So I believe that's the statewide chapter. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to him a couple times in the past, and he is, the way he speaks of it, it's something he seems to truly care about professionally in a way I don't often hear in politicians. So he has certainly built a career of his own in the time in his young adulthood.
Abby Livingston is covering this story as Washington Bureau Chief for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Abby, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, hello there, Wells.
Howdy, David.
What are you seeing from the folks on the
on the social media? Social media there. Yeah, well, let's check it out. You know, we were talking about President Trump earlier in the program, the impeachment proceedings and whatnot. Our friends and listeners appear to be hung up on another, talking point from the Trump administration that broke over the weekend. You know, during this small business event at the White House, President Trump announced that he was going to be ordering a federal review into water efficiency standards in the bathroom, and it was specifically his conversation of toilets. Get straight into it, that has folks talking. You know, he was he said that we have a situation, quote, we have a situation where we're looking very strongly at sinks and showers and other elements of bathrooms when you turn the faucet on, went on to talk about, I guess this was a sort of indictment of low-flow toilets, because he said people are flushing toilets 10 times, 15 times, as opposed to once. They end up using more water. I seem to recall a King of the Hill episode that sort of entailed these issues, but 10 to 15 seems like a little bit of a stretch.
Seems like a lot.
Captured the public imagination on social media, I would say, David.
I bet it has.
One listener says 3 to 4 times is probably enough. On a slightly more serious note, Steve Bridges says, the minimum wage was set nearly 30 years ago. The middle class has not had a raise in 40 years. We give corporate farmers an $18 billion handout and cut taxes for the top 10%, and this is what the president is talking about. So lots of and just to sort of put things in context, all the other stuff that was happening that day, I believe that was the day that there was that shooting on a Air Force base. That was Friday.
You're talking about in Florida. Down in Pensacola,
I believe. So strange story. Folks are talking about it. Well, you know, speaking of bowls, how's this for a segue? The Texas Longhorns have eked out a bowl appearance, making it to the Alamo Bowl against 11th ranked Utah. This set for New Year's Eve, these college bowl games.
I don't think the folks at the Alamo Bowl will like your comparison. I understand where you're coming. Yes, I appreciate the bowls.
Lots of bowls, bowl talk in general, broke over the weekend. Baylor facing off against Georgia in the Sugar Bowl there on New Year's Day in New Orleans. Oklahoma State taking it up against Texas A&M in the Texas Bowl December 27th. SMU, the Ponies, they're going to be facing Florida Athletics Owls in the Boca Raton Bowl. So it looks like most of the
Boca Raton Bowl.
So most of the bowl game is bowl games are set there. Lots of talk about what this. I think some people were surprised by UT Austin making it there. Burnt Orange Nation on Twitter, they wrote that a win for the Longhorns in the Alamo Bowl would represent another upset for a Tom Herman team, according to the opening betting line released on Sunday. So I guess that's what the markets are saying about the bowl game, the bowl prospects there for the Horns there.
Still tough for the Horns. I mean, you know, the expectation of game and all that kind of stuff. People expecting the Horns always to have a championship season, and a couple of rough ones. This
you know, just a state school working with the resources it has.
the single most profitable football program, football program, in the world.
So folks talking about that, keeping an eye on impeachment stuff as well. So you know, just never a dull news day in 2019, especially here in the waning days of it already here in December.
You got your shopping done?
Nope. Haven't even really started.
That's kind of what I'm scared about. I'm looking at this calendar over here, and gosh, we're out of time on this December 9th. It's getting away from us, man. We're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the team, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.